me so much. Couldn't get a word out for about 10 minutes.
Okay, we're going to wait one more minute, then we're going to start.
You know, we have some snow out there after the snow king and queen came.
Mm-hmm.
And Damian said it was the snow dust from them building the Crystal Palace in the spirit.
Oh, nice. How beautiful.
Yeah.
We are recording now.
Oh, great. Thank you, Sol.
You're welcome.
Did it record last time, Sol?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, good.
Nicola, we wet
car. Okay, I know what you want.
Hi, Nicola.
Hi.
Marcia Hammond's here.
Hi, Marcia.
Hi, you're blessed. Nancy Frainer here.
This is Gwendolyn Clatter, too.
Hi, Nancy. Hi,
Gwendolyn. Hi.
Anne-Marie, are you here?
Yes.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Who else whose voice I haven't heard? I haven't heard, Isabella, are you here? Gwendolyn, are you there? Hi, Gwendolyn.
Hello, this is Caroline.
Hi, Caroline. You enjoyed all of the youth programs over the weekend. Thank you, Gwendolyn. Okay, I'm going to begin our invocation then, and people can keep coming on while we're giving it, I guess. And I will read the list of names so you all know who's on the class, and I'll use that in the invocation. In the name of the I Am That I Am, in the name of the Holy Christ Buddha cells of each one attending this conference, we have Hermes Albertus, Robert Allison, Elizabeth Anderson, Michael Arnett, Cheryl Bench, Kathleen Chu, Carol Daly, Lisa Delaney, Patricia DeWitt, Linda Dowell, Donna Dregan, Ronaldo Dubrowski, Carolyn Denegan, Jackie Fletter, Nancy Frainer, Rosa Flores, Donald Galvin, Pamela Gambica, Joyce Hennis, Medel Goulart, Marcia Hammond, Lenore Harris, Janice Haugen, Arnie Jaltadorter, Anita Hulbert, Ilona Iris, Gwendolyn Kletter, Donna Korth, Deborah Lamore, Richard Lorenz, Marie Min, Sol Monroy, Anne-Marie Aloney, Julie Oxford, Doreen Pachurowski, Josephine Starr, Carol Wells, Constance Welzel, Tom Wilk, Mary Wilk, Nicola Wojwitka, Patricia Carlson, John Turnquist, Gregory Mascari, Hendrika Leardom, Ken Mueller, Nancy Mueller, Patrick Roger, Tucker Rogers, John Spinuzzi, and Isabel McNeil, and the other board members who are attending. We call now to beloved God and Goddess Meru. We call to beloved Gautama Buddha. We call to beloved Lord Maitreya, beloved Lanalawan Mother. We call to beloved Lord Lanto, beloved Confucius, and all of the masters who serve on the Yellow Ray, including Claire Louise Kininger, Ruth Farnham, Ruth Jones, Marguerite Baker, and all others who have ascended from our activity who were teachers by profession. We ask for your overshadowing presence, and we ask that the recently ascended masters overshadow each one of us in our outreach. And whatever topic we've chosen, whatever ray we are speaking on, whatever dispensation we are claiming and bringing down from our own mighty I Am Presence and Holy Christ Self, we ask for the appropriate master who has specialization and mastery in that area to overshadow us and help us to prepare our materials and our ideas that we will have the greatest release of light through this word crystallized through our hearts and brought forth, not only in this class, but in the future days to come as this material is used with other people and other audiences. We thank you for your overshadowing presence with us always. We thank you for opportunity. We thank you for joy and love and community and this wonderful opportunity to share with one another and to prepare to bring the teachings of the Great White Brotherhood to those souls who are so hungry and so waiting for us to become ready to meet with them. We thank you and ask for your blessing, and we ask for this protection this night. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Okay. So now how many people are on? Let's somebody who just recently came on identify themselves and tell us how many people are on so far?
Hi, this is Pamela, and they said 32 or 33, I can't remember.
Okay. All right, so majority are here anyway. What we're going to do tonight, I know everyone, some of you are probably just getting back home from the weekend, and some of us are getting ready to go to Asia in a week, and everybody's probably very busy right about now, and some of the homework or some of the assignments might be starting to feel a little onerous to you, a little burdensome, but remember our burden is light, and miracles are possible. Just to give you an example, Tom was asked by St. Germain to prepare a video for to show in Hawaii. It seemed like it would be an undaunting task, but when it came down to it, he actually got it done in a day. It was a miracle. So I'm sure you'll get help, too, if you ask. So we're going to start out by sharing our experiences with the rubrics, with the syllabi, anyone who has questions or concerns. And then we're going to have a couple more presentations, and then I'll go over the documentation and copyright law issues. And then we're going to change the order and have the characteristics of the adult learner before the teaching strategies. And Anita will do the adult learner. And then when she's finished, I'll make a few comments based on my experience as well. And then we'll end up with the teaching strategies. And if we have time at the end, we'll do more presentations. And we'll make sure that you're all set to know what to do with your final assignments for this class. Next, last class, as you know. And we'll have one more class on January the 9th, same time, same place, same station, if you would like to do your five-minute presentation. It's not a requirement, but if you'd like that experience, then we're happy to be together and do that together. So let's start out with the rubric. I know for most of you it probably was a new concept, and you may have never done a rubric before. You may have never seen a rubric before. But I hope you got the way of assigning numbers to some rather abstract concepts. Instead of just saying, well, I learned a few things, we're saying, okay, if you learned a few things, that's a number two. If you learned lots of things, that's going to become a number three. And if you didn't learn much at all, you're going to get a number one. And then by adding up these numbers, dividing by the number of squares in the rubric, then you get an average score that you can translate into a grade or into a percentage point. So it's a way of trying to assign numerical value to something that's rather abstract, which is learning. You can have rubrics that are very have many more boxes. You could have had five across and 12 down. I mean, people can get very complex. I try to keep it very simple with three across and a few down the left-hand side. So let me just ask if anybody would like to share what they put in their boxes going down the left-hand side. Now, if you put just what I gave you, don't say it. If you put something different, that was fine. You could do that. So let's just share with each other what we might have put in the left-hand side of the boxes, what it is that we were actually evaluating in the rubric, and that was what went down the left-hand column. So could anyone who did something different pipe up now and share that with us, please?
Well, this is Josephine, seeing as no one else has jumped in. My topic was unleash the power of affirmations to create the life you want. So that was the little center of my concept map. And I had four big chunks coming out from that center. And I used those four chunks to go down the left-hand side. And those chunks were like how, what, why, and the fourth one was when and where, combined together.
Okay.
So number one was like how, you know, to do the information, different components, why they work, like the psychology, the quantum physics, or what all the applications are, and the when and where kind of lumped them together. And that they went down the left-hand side.
So then across the top you had the 1, 2, 3, and then you were going to assign numerical value to how many of those concepts they were actually numbered?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, great. Anybody else have one they would like to share?
Celeste, I had a hard time doing the rubric, and I wonder if some other people had the same problems that I did. I just really couldn't understand the concept. I couldn't put it together.
And okay. So let's try with your topic. Let's work on your topic and help you out with this. Okay, what was your topic? So let me see. It's on my list here.
Yeah.
Your topic was how to acquire dominion over self.
Right.
Okay, so what were you going to use as the criteria for how you were going to know that someone had learned something in your presentation?
So you're evaluating yourself before you do the syllabus?
No. The person, I'm sorry, when I meant you, I meant the person who's in your take, how are they going to know, how are you as a teacher going to know that your students have learned how to acquire dominion over self?
That's what I couldn't do because I hadn't done the syllabus. The syllabus was easier to do, but doing the rubric before didn't work for me.
Okay, that's fine. But were you able to do it after you did the syllabus?
No, because
no.
I didn't have time.
Okay, so let's go back to your syllabus now. How are you going to know that your students are going to know how to acquire dominion over self?
Well, I have these different topics that I'm talking about. I'm talking about meditation, different forms of meditation, prayer, journal writing.
Okay.
let's see. And then I was going to talk about emotional freedom techniques, which is something I have been studying and I find very effective. And that's one way of centering yourself, because if you're upset, it's very difficult. You have to go to the source of your problem before you can try to resolve it.
From what you just said to me, Sol, the one that jumps out at me as one that you could actually have some paper to go with it would be the journaling.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, maybe you could ask for a journal sample that would demonstrate to you, the instructor, that the person had acquired some dominion over themselves by what they had written in their journal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would take that and you would use that then to create your rubric to evaluate that journal sample.
Okay.
So you have to have a way to show growth and change and so forth and learning. And if you ask, it'd be more difficult if you say, well, okay, meditate here in front of me for 5 minutes. Let's just say, you know, I mean, really masterful beings could do this, the masters could do this, but we couldn't probably do that. But, you know, say, okay, meditate in front of me for 5 minutes and I'll tell our dominion over self. Well, we couldn't do that, right? We wouldn't be able to show any way that that person had acquired dominion over self unless we were evaluating whether they twitched and turned or fidgeted or rubbed their nose or something for that 5 minute period.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? But if you have a writing sample, then that's an easier way to evaluate.
Yeah. Well, I guess I didn't understand the concept of the rubric.
So the rubric is just to help you to assign numbers to something that you're going to evaluate to show that you, in fact, have taught a concept or a student has acquired a concept.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a measurement, right?
Yeah.
So you're measuring the student's learning after you have given the class.
Right, or in the middle of it,
along
the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and also, so you can use it to measure your own teaching as well. So let's say, for example, you collect these writing samples and you read about 20 of them and you decide that these students are not getting mastery over themselves. They're losing their harmony, they're getting upset, they're striking back, whatever. Then you think, oh, my goodness, I better spend some more time talking about this concept because they're not getting it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
See? So it can help you as a teacher also evaluate where to go.
Okay. Thank you.
It's just a tool. That's all. Okay. So does that help you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so anyone else? Yes?
Oh, this is Marcia Hammond. I think I would just like to comment that I think perhaps one thing that might be getting a little bit in the way for some of us or some of the students here is that really what we are imagining that we're preparing to do is to share mostly the teachings, to be able to speak and maybe do a class with other students of the light and that kind of thing, although I know this can apply to many things. But this is so oriented to a classroom situation that's a little more formal, I think, than most of us are considering perhaps that we will actually be doing. Does that make sense?
Well, yes and no, because because it's true, it's something that you probably would use where you teach people over and over and over and you see them for more than one time.
Yeah.
But there's no reason why you can't, as an evaluation for your workshop, ask people to do something for you and then turn it into a rubric after you've collected it and score yourself and use this concept to evaluate your own presentation.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is valuable. I was just offering that might be something that is a little bit of a difficulty for some of us.
Yeah. I think the thing that's happening now in the world of teaching is that we're asked to be accountable for what we are doing with students, whereas in the past it was just enough to do it and then nobody asked you to be accountable. And I think even, you know, on our board even, council, we've talked about, you know, well, how would we know that something was successful? Well, we won't know unless we somehow evaluate it. It just isn't going to be enough just to do it and then hope for the best, you know.
Okay,
so any way that you can adapt,
any way
you can adapt this matrix or another matrix, you know, you don't have to use a rubric per se to evaluate a presentation, but you ought to be able to have something as a feedback so that you can improve your own teaching and your own presentation so that they'll get better every time.
Celeste, I was just going to say, this is Kathleen, I was just going to say something similar, that if you can measure it, then you can improve it. Because how do you know how and even where to improve it if you can't figure out what part could be better? And you can figure out what part could be better if you know if the students got what you were trying to say.
It's not easy to work with these just right off the bat. You kind of have to kind of get used to it. But once you get used to them, they're fairly helpful, although they do have their limitations. Because they are somewhat nebulous. Like, Cheryl, you sent one in to me, and I looked at it, and would you care to read just the top line, 1, 2, 3, for your top line? I don't have it here in front of me. But
where I put exceptional increase in all three areas.
What was your number one under for your top line?
Oh, number one was a small increase in three areas.
Okay, and you didn't say what the three areas were, right?
Well, yeah, I did. I put, they were in the first box, and that was historical, spiritual, and philosophical knowledge of the divine.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay, so number two then, your number two box was what?
And the number two was the moderate, number two was comprehension of past and current culture and trends.
Okay, and number three?
And number three was how the knowledge of the Divine Mother can change cultures.
Okay, so those were her three, and as you work with these, Cheryl, I think you probably will refine them as you go along, but it gives you some place to start.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, does anybody else want to share their experiences with the rubric?
Yes, this is Maria. Do you hear me?
Yes.
I enjoyed working on this rubric because I have to focus on what I want to convey to my students.
Uh-huh.
And by focusing on that, it was much easier for me to start planning for the workshop.
Uh-huh.
If I inspire them, then it is easier for me where I have to put more stress on in explaining. And I enjoyed working first with the rubric and then with the syllabus. I used to do it the other way around.
Okay, now let's ask you, yours was compassionate communication, so can
correct.
You tell us going down the left side?
The first column is clarity of Dr. Rosenberg's four-step communication strategy. And then they can have the numbers if they have no increase in their clarity. Then it is 0 points. If they have little increase, it is one. If it is okay, it is two. And much improvement, then it is three. So this is overall the categories that I want them to put a number in.
Okay.
And then my second one is ability to start applying Dr. Rosenberg's four-step communication strategy. They will have an opportunity in this workshop to apply, so they can judge themselves by that. Number three is knowledge, how you hinder your ability to apply compassionate communication. by covering the rose in your heart and blocking the flow of the divine healing and energy. My fourth box is ability to recognize your own thought action pattern of judging, labeling, diagnosing, analyzing, comparing, demanding. It's your own fault thinking pattern, and you or I should do it. So these are all related to what I wanted to express in this workshop.
Okay.
I have four more. Do you want me to read these too?
No, that's good. So people can get the idea of how she applied. That's very good. It's a good example, Maria.
Thank you.
Easy, because you had one thing you were focused on.
True.
I mean, the 4 points, right? The 4 principles.
Right.
Yeah. So those of you who didn't get to it yet, you can use these examples, and as you work with your syllabus, maybe it'll become clearer to you how to assess what it is that you really want them to learn. And remember, you don't assess everything, because you can't. You just assess something that you think is going to really show you that they've mastered some aspect of what you've been teaching about. Something that you really want to know about, or you think that they could benefit from seeing their growth and learning. Okay, so let's move on to the syllabi now. Did anyone have any issues around creating the syllabi that they would like to share? Syllabus, I guess, in your case.
It was actually pretty easy after doing the, the concept map and the rubric, and to follow your outline of how to do it. It actually went fairly fast.
Who is this talking, please?
This is Josephine. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So you didn't have any troubles with it. Okay.
The only
else?
Thing I didn't know was like. I don't know how long it's going to take. It says like date, time, location. I don't know how much time it will take because I haven't done all the research yet for all the various things I want to present and talk
right.
about.
Right.
So the time, I'm just guessing.
Yeah, that's okay. It's just a pretend, you know.
Yeah.
If I really was going to do it, what would I do and how? And which nights would I do what, or what hour would I spend on whatever? Practice.
Well, this is Cheryl, and I thought it was really fun because it got me excited about doing it. as I, wrote down each class and what we were going to talk about and then figured out some assignments, I thought, wow, this looks like really neat. I'm excited about this. I hope I get to do it sometime.
Good. I hope you do, too.
Well, this is Richard, and with my concept diagram, I just had, way too much data, and I'm not sure I could get it all on, but when I got to the syllabus, it started outlining it, and it started, in fact, looking at the concept map, I didn't even know what I wanted to present. There is so much material there. I, of course, picked from my little talk the Kabbalah. There's a little bit of detail there.
Yeah.
But I was having trouble, and still maybe having trouble with the rubric. But once I got to the syllabus, it came out pretty straightforward and helped me organize my thoughts and. Now I can make a course that sounds, that kind of hangs together. Basically, there's so much you can discuss. What do you have to go back and review or set up for a particular point or path that you want to take or string? And so I kind of did that, and now I'm working on the rubric and still trying to get organized. There's an awful lot I have to put together, and I have to do a little more research yet. But I think the syllabus helped me most so far.
What have you got in your rubric to evaluate? What are you evaluating at this point?
Actually, nothing much. I'm Like I say, I sit there and look dazed, and I haven't had a lot of time to work this last week, and so I really didn't get to it. I got a better idea now that I finished my syllabus, which was just in the last couple of days, and but I just haven't been able to get to it.
Okay. Well, I'll be interested to see what you come up with for your rubric.
Okay.
Sure, it'll be great. Okay. One more person to share, and then we're going to move on, I think, to our next topic.
So let's, Kathleen,
sure.
You again. One of the things that I noticed in doing it is that by breaking it down into all the individual pieces, it made me be much more organized. And also it made me see how if I want to do presentations to different levels, how I can use different either leave out some topics totally for beginning people or really simplify them, and having this, it all laid out in like a skeleton like this, it made it much easier to see what to put in for which level and what to take out for others.
Were any of you amazed at what you actually knew about something that you didn't really think too much about what you actually knew about it?
Mm-hmm.
To realize how much you really did know once you started putting it all down in the concept map? Yeah. Great. Well, I'm pleased. I think you've all done a great job, the ones who shared, and if others are still struggling along, then maybe you'll be inspired by the successes of those who felt, you know, capable of getting it done for tonight anyway. Okay, so we're going to ask Anita to randomly pick two people on our list to give 5-minute presentations.
Okay. I just want to mention one thing that Madame Gaspari always used to say. She would say sometimes it's not what you say, it's what you have to decide what not to say, because we do know a lot about a topic.
Yeah.
And we have to have some discipline in leaving some things out that we would love to tell people, but it can just be too much. So it's very interesting to decide what it is you are going to say. It's interesting. Okay, so here we go with the magic wheel. Okay. Julie Oxford, meditating, decreeing with the elementals. Are you ready, Julie? Well, my finger went to number 35. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I'm glad you picked me because I thought you were. For
you
some
did.
Reason.
Well, I didn't know.
I don't. But I wanted to share, actually, with Celeste's last question about the syllabus. It was just, I'm kind of new to the banquet, you guys. So I was listening to your Mike McNeil and how he was discussing it, all the things that the masters have told you guys to do. And that whole time, I mean, I was so inspired that I think with Master Moyer, well, I think it was at that time that Master Moyer asked us individually what we would do, what we would contribute, and to write it on a piece of paper and to copy it and to, burn it and burn the copy and send it to him. So lo and behold, I, not even knowing about this coming up, I did a syllabus on what I'm actually going to be reading about right now. So So that's kind of what I wanted to share. But am I ready for this? Well, okay, I wanted to do meditating and decreeing with the elementals.
And I'll ring a little bell when 5 minutes are up if you're still going.
Oh,
okay. All right.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
And so I wanted to deal with flowers because that is where I gather the greatest inspiration for all decrees that I do. And I just wanted to start with a quote from Gautama, who says, we are what we think. Everything that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. So I think good and beautiful and perfect thoughts when I look at flowers and that which is reflected in the faces and the fragrance of the flowers. So I wanted to pick flowers for precipitating clear images when we are going to be giving decrees. As the masters have said, that is key for the creation that's intended through a carefully crafted thought form. So in giving blessings or decrees or fiats to the elemental kingdom, the more intimate our understanding of these beings, the more powerful will be the sending, which is Moria's term from his 30s books. And I think that's a real strong word. I love that word, ascending. So the strand that I picked is just a peek into the world of the shy elementals to contact them most personally, the beauty and the perfection of the magnificent flowering plants, so that we may more fully know them, that we may more fully gnosis them. I thought of gnosis, the gnomes, the sensitive, specialized, and precious beings that they are. And to use this knowing to develop an intense love for them so that our sendings may be as powerful and as swift and as effective as Master Moria's sendings are. So first, what I would have the students do is to create a home within our physical bodies through a deep knowing of flowers by concentrating on each of our senses one at a time. And this should have been a practical, this would have been a laboratory, ideally. Because you need to have the flower in front of you to use all of our senses. And the idea being that once we have used all the five senses, then we would use our sixth, actually, would be an outpouring from all of that we have imbibed with the five. And the sixth would lead us into our sixth sense of Buddhic intuition, would hopefully take over the reins, uplifting our fiat to Tushita Heaven, where we would be then ready to offer the blessing to the Buddha. I was inspired by John Ville, and what we allow into our consciousness can be imprinted, all that we take into us. So using that analogy, with a flower in front of us, knowing how sensitive elementals are and knowing how sensitive our souls are, we can become the flower, and by using all our senses, taking pictures of them with our souls and using them in our memories to meditate with the flowers later. And then I wanted to get a better understanding for children, actually, is what I usually share this kind of teaching with, but we are adult children, so I wanted to go deeper into, for adults as we are, deeper into a definition of fohat, which is used a lot in theosophical society. So I took from the Theosophical Occultism Mysticism Dictionary their definition of fohat, which is a mystical term used in Tibet for what in Sanskrit is called, and I really don't know how to pronounce this, D-A-I-V-I-P-R-A-K-R-I-T-I, Daiviprakriti, which means divine nature or primordial light. And fohat may be considered, they go on to say fohat may be considered as, is that me?
Well, you can finish your sentence.
Okay, well, I'll finish it with what Blavatsky said. Blavatsky is noted for quoting one of the ancient mystically occult works. She says, in substance, fohat is the steed like the horse. Fohat is the steed, and thought is the rider.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Oh, I'll find a flower.
I want to do it.
I love my garden.
I know. I heard you say that.
My garden's frozen right now. Okay. So, we'll do another one right now. Let's see. Donald Galvin.
Okay, I'm ready. I just, it's funny, as you called my name, and I just made a call to Mahachwan to pick me if it was God's will. because I really wanted to share this. Anyways, my topic, 5-minute topic, is little lessons learned along the way, life's way.
Mm-hmm.
And, the purpose of doing this and is that I have the key knowledge of the lessons that I have learned in life all along the path, and then that was the first thing that I would like to share those, and then how to make them meaningful to others. We may not be able to do that part this evening, but you know, if this was a longer presentation or course, whatever, then we could do that. But that would be my primary purpose, to share and then to make them meaningful to others and to discuss them. So anyway, the very first one I would like to say is I can teach with an exclamation point. Prior to this class, I did not think I could teach. I mean, I knew I could teach something, but not. I didn't think I was really a teacher. So all the ingredients of this class, Celeste and Anita, everybody sharing, the masters behind us, and I went, I must have gone to a retreat two nights in a row. I woke up about 3:30 in the morning, and I was awake till about maybe 5:30, two nights in a row. And as I woke up, all these things came tumbling into my mind, what I could share. And at the very end, this enlightenment, like this light bulb went off, was, I can teach. it was a wonderful experience. And so, but it was all the ingredients. It wasn't just me. It wasn't, you know, it was all the whole, and being obedient, I think, to a Maitreya's request. So the very first story I guess I would like to tell you is the power of wisdom to convert. I don't think we necessarily think that wisdom is, when we think of conversion, we think of probably the conversion of the Holy Spirit, maybe the flame of love, somebody who's going down the wrong path and suddenly they're converted to God. But when I was in Vietnam, I had experience when I was there, I used to smoke cigarettes. And I wrote a letter to Mother and I said, you know, is cigarette smoking bad? I felt it was. She gave me the teaching that while I was in Vietnam, Archangel Gabriel could not give me the fullest protection I needed because of the astral substance and the aura. So I read the letter. I had one pack of cigarettes in my pocket. I took one more cigarette, I think I smoked it, and then I threw the rest of the pack away and never spoke from that day on. So it was the teaching, the power of wisdom, that helped me instantaneously almost to overcome a bad habit. So what I'd like to convey, if we had a discussion, is, you know, what the power of wisdom can do to other people. Just a little lesson, a little teaching can turn their life around. It's an amazing thing, and so I wanted to praise the power of wisdom to convert one or another. That's one of life's little lessons. Another one that I would like to share is keeping the flame of love. I try to, more recently as I'm in the Heart Center, when I'm going about my business or when I'm in stores, just flame of love in my heart. Well, I went into a Barnes & Noble store, I think I told this to someone, but I went into a Barnes & Noble store, and these two ladies were going through these magazines. They had about 10 magazines each, and they were sitting on this bench facing each other and just flipping through the magazines. And I felt, you know, why aren't they paying for these magazines? Why aren't they, instead of just flipping through them and reading them, why aren't they paying for them? So it was almost like I was the proprietor of the store, and I had a sense of injustice. And then I realized that concept was preventing me from sending out love to them or just, you know, just being, having a good concept about them. So I immediately changed that feeling. I discarded it. I put it out of my mind, and I went back to where I wanted to be. And then I realized that the importance of mindfulness in life, mindful of your thoughts, your feelings, because so easily we can be overtaken by subtle things that maybe they may come from our electronic belt, they may come from a projection, whatever. But it's important to be mindful so that we can really, keep the flame on behalf of others. That's another little lesson I learned. I don't know how much time I have left, but...
Well, you have time for about another 40 seconds.
40 seconds.
Which is another whole point. You could do the third one.
Okay. All right. Lesson of humility. Okay. Lesson of humility learned through the art of decreeing is one. You know, we think sometimes we've been decreeing for a number of years that that it's us decreeing. And when you analyze, you break it down, you think, well, the word that I give forth, that memory of those words, which came to my mind, I did not create that memory. The feelings of love and joy, I did not create them. The brain to do it all, I did not make my physical brain. I wouldn't know how to make a brain. The light that comes tumbling through is God's light. The throat chakra, that chakra was created by God. I have no involvement in it. And the physical tongue that uses the wag to give the decrees is another of God's creation. So when you break it all down, it's all God's work, and you are nothing, or I am nothing. But then you realize God in me is the all where I am. And you have to keep on reminding yourself, not only in those situations, but in all life situations, because it's very easy for the ego to think it's the doer. So by meditating on these concepts, it helps you to remain humble and to realize that you're not the doer, that God is the doer. I'm not the doer, God is the doer. And then you realize God is the doer in everything you do. So that's another lesson I learned from life that I'd like to share.
Thank you.
And where I would go with this, I would discuss it.
We'll look forward to hearing lots more.
Excuse me?
We'll look forward to hearing lots more.
Lots more, okay.
Time to come.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Donald.
Thank you,
Donald. You're welcome.
Hope you're writing all these down. I can hear Mother saying in the back of my mind, make sure he's writing all those stories down.
Yeah, I just think we wake up with, you know, one or two a day and just think what a book you'll have in a year's time.
Right, and I was just thinking of Maitre it's Gautama Buddha. He said, tell your story. Tell it again, tell it again, you know, because everybody needs to hear our stories. Everybody needs to hear this.
We all have our stories to tell.
Right,
right.
Okay, we're going to move on now in the interest of time, just to get through all the main material, and we'll come back to some presentations if we have time. So if you will look at the handout, which is titled number 5, which says Documentation and Copyright Laws. You've probably had a chance to read it. I just want to reiterate for you the importance of...
What page is it, Celeste?
It's page 9.
Okay.
I just want to reiterate for you the importance of keeping your notes accurate as to where the source is that you quoted from. As I said last week, you may end up writing a book someday, even though now you may not think you ever would. You know, 10 years from now, you could be in a different place in your life, and this would not be such a huge concept to contemplate. So, you know, keep good notes of your sources. And then as far as referencing them for your syllabus, you can use either the APA style or the MLA style. Doesn't matter to me which one you use. Just be consistent. The APA style you can find online at the American Psychological Association website. I think it's a .org, American Psychological Association. The MLA style you have to find in a book called the MLA Handbook. They don't have theirs online. Don't know why not, but they haven't put it there. So, you know, your library will have these books. Just try to, you know, make your syllabus as professional as you can now, because that way when comes time to actually doing this, you'll have it all in the right order. So generally speaking, the author's name is first. MLA style, they use the first name completely. APA style only uses the first initial. And then you kind of go from there. So I'm not going to go into it much on the phone, but you can look that up and pick whichever one you prefer to use. Some of you may have college books lying around still that give you either one of those. And as far as quoting goes, you know, 500 words is considered to be an appropriate quote. I worked for an entire year publishing some other keepers, something called the Meru Guild e-zine, and we had to write and ask permission from the Summit Lighthouse to quote every month. We had to submit our quotes, and they were fact-checked, and we were given permission to quote. And online, our term of being able to quote ended up being something like 2 months. That's what the church was willing to give us. And we never did publish any of that in print, so we didn't have to deal with trying to get permission to do it in print. But I have worked closely with the staff that are in charge of that department at the Summit Lighthouse, and I know that it's quite involved, and they are very you know, as long as you're reading it out loud, it doesn't matter how many words you use, but if someday you ever wanted to turn that into a text, you would have to go back and get permission to quote, to put in print everything you've spoken. So you might keep that in mind when you're preparing your lectures so that you don't have so much material that's based on Summit Lighthouse literature that you couldn't possibly publish it if you ever wanted to. So
what about if you're doing if you're doing something audio recorded, do you not Summit Lighthouse but other kinds of books, do you speak, say, well, from this author I have this? I mean, do you need to say that along the way?
Yes, you do, and that's also copyrighted. So if you're going to publish it as far and sell it, for example, if we were going to sell a class, a Meru class that you were teaching, that where you, it's best to try to put as much in your own words and organize information in the way that is yours, uniquely yours, and then that way there isn't as much of a copyright issue.
So if you're giving like a little presentation at a conference, even though you're reading aloud, it's still being recorded on video or audio. So then
that's
there's
right.
a limit, right?
Right, there's a limit, and you couldn't just read on page after page after page.
Yeah.
From someone's book.
Is it still a 500-word limit then, if you're at a conference or something?
Yeah, that's not a problem. If you're under 500 words, you never have to worry. In fact, some copyright lawyers will even say you can go up to 1,000 words, but just to be on the safe side, I threw out the 500 number since that's the one the church uses and So that's something you have to be thinking about all the time. We especially have to be thinking about that because. We it could be that someday we'll have these on DVD and people could actually attend classes in other ways. And they're not picky, they're not picky because the Summit Lighthouse quoted many, many, many things and never got permission to do so. But I would say they probably don't have a very good taste in their mouth regarding our having taken such license with their materials.
This is David. I'd like to make a comment on that.
Go right ahead.
The IM movement has fairly recently sued the Temple of the Presence, and I don't know the context upon which they were sued, but I know that if you look at the recent books that they've published, they have an incredible amount of copyrights and trademarks listed in the beginning of their books. So I would tend to actually be very careful with them right now because they seem to be making a huge effort to copyright things. And since there is a lawsuit going on that I've heard of recently, I wouldn't be so liberal as to say that we could just use their stuff without the same constraints that we would use for the Summit Lighthouse.
Okay. So that's just... Yeah, I think it's best to err on the side of caution and just not be quoting lots and lots of people all over the place. I know Mother in her lectures would do a lot of quoting from books, and a lot of those lectures could never be released because there was so much quoting from books that they would have to get so much copyright permission that teaching will never be released. And it's really unfortunate.
Celeste, we have a question about that. About the research for presentations and everything.
Yeah.
As long as we are, as you say, if we're at the beginning of a paragraph and we're reading or researching several paragraphs or whatever, as long as we mention it as we go along, this is from such and such in book, and then you do that and then you add your comments and you do it again, then
right.
As long as the author and the information is mentioned, then that suffices to give them proper credit. Is that basically correct?
Yes, as long as you're keeping it within about 500 words. So
well, that
different,
see that
different
that
author.
Might vary. In other words, something that was 15 pages long might not be limited to 500 words if you're just using a few resources.
Well, what I'm trying to say here is any one particular author in any one place in your paper should be about 500 words.
Okay.
You can use this, the same author several places, but if your entire paper is
okay.
quote after quote after quote after quote from that author,
I see.
Then the author could choose to think that you have infringed upon the copyright.
I see.
because you've quoted so much information.
Okay.
Well, I had a question.
You can also pay for it. If you're going to take a lot from another author, just know that it might just cost you money.
But yeah.
Now, I had a question about that 500 words. Is that cumulative or just in one piece at a time?
That's in one piece at a time.
Okay.
It depends, though. With a summit, we kind of went over that sometimes, and we got away with up to 1,000 points. But generally speaking, 2 or 3 pages that we published monthly, we limited ourselves to about 500 words if we could.
So, Celeste, how does that work with spiritual concepts? Like, if you're teaching something that was related, for example, just through the summit, not through any other activity, would you be allowed to paraphrase it and still give the same understanding? Or is it, like, if you're teaching about the cosmic clock, for example, are you allowed to teach that even though it was just related to the summit?
You can't teach the whole concept of the cosmic clock, but you can quote things from the cosmic clock, and you can say, as Elizabeth Prophet spoke about in the book Great White Brotherhood, you know, in chapter such and such, she gave a full teaching on the cosmic clock, and then you can refer to, you know, a couple of concepts from it, but you couldn't just start to teach the cosmic clock and use every single thing out of that book and then
okay, thank you.
But Celeste,
yeah.
How does that work? Say, for instance, in the past, we would have directly taken a major concept and almost tried to duplicate it.
Right, we can't do that. That's my point.
I mean, as Heart Center, we can't do it, but I mean, as individuals, if we would have been still with the church, we could have.
If the church had given you permission. But you would have still have had to have gotten permission. And you still would have had to have sent in which quotes you were going to use. They would have fact-checked to make sure you had them all correctly, you know, typed out, spelled out, commas, everything, exactly the way they were, and then they would have given you permission to use it. And they would have given you permission to use it for a specific time, perhaps maybe only one time. Maybe you can use it in this article, for example, but you couldn't use it any other way at any other time. It's quite restrictive, actually.
You know, I would doubt, generally speaking, that anybody that was taking out particular pieces of the teaching, unless they're working directly with a teaching center, would have even known that. They would have just taken the information, assembled it, and, you know, called together a seminar or had...
Well, I know. They didn't know it, so they gave workshops every July class, trying to get everyone to come to these workshops and learn these basic rules. But people were breaking rules right and left all the time.
Nobody really...
So we don't, you know, we can quote from our own teachings within limit. I mean, you'd have to, you know, if you were going to publish something, you'd have to check with David and the council to make certain that, you know, the way it was going to go out was something that the Heart Center would approve of. But, you know, we have our own teachings now. We should trying to use them as much as possible to explain concepts and to reinforce our ideas But once again, you couldn't just take a whole pearl, a heart stream, let's just say, and send it off to Reader's Digest and publish it to illustrate some story you were telling. Let's just say, for example, I don't know if they'd publish it, but anyway, just can imagine here that you just send it off and have it published without checking with anybody at the Heart Center to see if you had permission to do that.
Right, that makes sense. Well, we appreciate learning about this because as we're beginning to put together this different information, if we start from the beginning and know what the legal parameters are, then we're able to work within that. Whereas if we didn't really know that before, we never know what you come out with. And the second thing is, since, you know, hopefully a lot of us will be putting together information that will eventually get into prints, whether they become resources of the Heart Center or just means of supplying, spreading the teaching. So it's good to have this foundation.
Right. And, you know, eventually we'll have to have a whole department, just like the Summit Lighthouse does, that does nothing but check, you know, takes care of all of this copyright business, but right now we're a volunteer organization and we just, you know, hope that everybody will be honorable and use everything in ways that won't make them karma, that's all.
What about
when did the copyright disappear? 100 years or what is it?
We can't quite hear whoever's speaking. Okay, so we're going to move on.
Do you hear my question about the time?
Pardon?
When does the copyright go away? Is it 100 years, or what? Doesn't it go away at some point?
They can be renewed.
No, they'll have that copyright for perpetuity, unless it's legally challenged in court, and that's another whole discussion.
Celeste, can I ask a question?
Sure.
What happens you have an idea, like coming through the Heart Center, dealing with the cosmic clock, such that you are involving concepts that came from else? How does all that work?
Well, that's tricky, because if you're just reiterating what's already been said, then you're basically infringing on copyright.
If you're
taking something that's been said and just a part of it, and you're expanding on it and adding new knowledge, then that's allowable.
Okay.
Or if you mention it and you say this is from the book and you can buy it from
right,
the
that's fine.
Because
it,
they want
your whole
want their
discussion.
Book to sell. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'll give an example of that, Celeste. I thought.
Celeste?
Yeah, that's so strange.
Sounds like Patricia.
This is David. I just want to make another point here.
Yes.
Anybody who is really a good writer is a student and studies from a wide range of materials and can bring to bear in their presentation snippets from a number of different sources. And
right.
So I encourage, and I think the masters really encourage you to become excellent students and well-read so that you can take concepts from many authors, even many that are currently bringing forth instruction right now in the domain of psychology and New Age thinking and spirituality, like Marianne Williamson and many others. And this makes your presentation more professional rather than just constantly quoting the summit or even us or the IM. I mean, I think that it's a new day and that people need to really kind of step up their scholarship. And I recall a dictation early on, something about that becoming a messenger was tantamount to like a PhD. Do you remember that, Celeste? And we are all like aspiring messengers, you know? And so you really have to become scholars and become well-read and get into your field that you're really looking at and not just plunk two or three sources, but really, I mean, I've been reading this Eighth Habit by Stephen Covey over the last week. He is incredible.
Yeah.
And he is bringing to bear so much of what we have learned through Mother in the last 20, 30 years, and it's all there in this book. I can tell you, it is phenomenal. And
can
so
I tell
we,
you that,
yeah, go ahead.
This university that I teach at is based on Covey's principles, the whole university.
Wow.
And our former president, who just left this year, is the brother-in-law of Stephen Covey.
And, wow.
And because of that, he brought the Covey principles here about 15 years ago. And it's just amazing. This whole university is based on the Covey principles, and here I am. Funny. Any case, so we're going to have to move on now because...
Could I get one more question about...
Sure, really quick, please.
Diagrams, pictures, diagrams, and or just general sketches. What are the copyright problems with those?
Well, you know what? We should have Tom Miller at some time give us a whole presentation on visuals because that's another whole topic altogether which has its own rules and regulations. So could we put that in the visual category? Maybe at our next class I can have him speak for a few minutes about those.
Certainly.
Because
yeah.
I know that people have taken liberties with that as well, and that's one of his strong suits. Okay, so we're going to have Anita now talk about adult learners. And it's now, what time is it now, Anita? It's 5 after, so
So tighten it up, huh?
If you can.
Okay, well, characteristics of the adult learner. Maitreya spoke to us on November 21st, and that's the reason that some of you probably signed up for this class. And I think one of the main themes of his talk to us was that we need to know the audience. So I'm just going to read this part. Therefore, this is Maitreya, you should know your audience. You should know each one's educational background so you can speak properly to the level of each one, so that one takes from your presentation something new, something exciting, something they can latch on to move forward in their path, beloved ones. This takes the gift of discernment of the Holy Spirit. And so there it is, your spiritual development. And so before your presentation, you must pray fervently for the descent of that gift of discernment and discrimination to know how and where and why and when the Spirit can move through you to touch a heart and a mind here and there. So there's two things in this. He's saying know your audience, know the people that are there, and ask for help. That's the masters are there for us, the Holy Spirit, to ask for that help, to help not just know our material, but help to have our sensitivity to our audience, because that's why it's so wonderful to teach real people instead of just put something on tape and then send it out and it's the same teaching, the same teaching, the same teaching, because you could be teaching the same subject, but your audience is always different, and so what you are giving out is depends on who's there. You know, it's a flow. I started teaching adults about 12 years ago, and what I quickly discovered is that, of course, they have different learning styles, as children do, but there's a couple things different about adults that I discovered quite quickly, and one of them is that they have different development. They're in different developmental stages. So in Montessori, we break everything down by developmental stages. So I may be working with a child age 3, 4, 5 in the same classroom, but they're in the same basic stage of development. They have the same kind of approach that we use toward supporting their development at that age. 6, 7, 8, 9 is a different stage of development. Well, when you have adults, you may have an 18-year-old, a 40-year-old, a 65-year-old, a 90-year-old, and 3 36-year-olds. And they're all in different stages of their life, which is significant in as to what their motivation may be to be attending your class. But the one thing, so that's what's different, is that they're in different developmental stages and they have different motivations. They're freely attending your class. They're not coming because their mommy sent them, but they have different motivations for why they're there. But the thing that I found that is in common with adults is very interesting, is that, in my opinion, most adult learning is transformational learning. They are looking to be transformed. They're coming not just to get a body of knowledge. They're coming to transform themselves, or to they're seeking that. And that is what people go back to school and they enroll in classes for, this transformational experience. They're coming to you for clues, for keys to their own personal process. It's their process. It's not ours. We can just help them along the way. Many are seeking a mentor, and they look to you to model. So what we do, what we say, how we present ourselves, who we are, how we think, everything about us, we are modeling, and so we keep that in mind. And as adults, we are all, and as children too, but I mean as adults, we always know that there's someone that we're teaching, someone who's looking to us, and there's always someone we're looking to, so it's this ladder, educational ladder. We're looking up to our teacher, and we're helping those that we can help, and so other people realize that too, and people are looking for a teacher that might know something that they don't know, and that person is you as a mentor and as a model, something to take so seriously. What I noticed about really young people, that young adults, that they're looking to start their lives and looking for a skill often in a career. They're searching. and they haven't gone through a whole lot, and so it's kind of fresh, whereas the 20s and 30s are sometimes looking for something more. They've had some education, they've had some experience, and maybe they're looking for something more. They haven't found what they thought they would. What I find with 40s and 50s, now this is just very general, but this is just from my experience, that sometimes 40s and 50s are really taking a real hard look at their life. They're moving to a transitional period where they're ready to turn and serve. They've been learning from others for all these years, and now it's time for them to be mentors and teachers, and so they may be looking for new skills and they're looking for an effective way to serve life. Now the 60s and up, I love these people, and I'm going to be joining them here pretty soon, but they are the lifelong learners. And the 60s, 70s, 80s people that come to classes, my gosh, they've been learning all their lives. They have inquiring minds. They're young at heart, and they are so golden. Often they're quite educated, knowledgeable. Often we have so much to learn from them, but what they have in common is that they're all consciously seeking what you have to offer, and they have chosen you. And so what it is, so they're coming to see what it is that you have. They've chosen it consciously, where children are not so consciously trying to transform themselves. Adults know that they're doing that, and it's so very interesting. So in thinking about why are they taking your class, what is their motivation? Well, the adult education literature has three major categories that I have found and that ring true to me. And that is, one motivation would be that they have a goal. So you can be thinking about people coming to you as, so, I mean, in your brain right now, you can be thinking about other people that are coming to you to learn, what is their, why are they coming? You can also be thinking of yourself, why did you take this class, for example, or other classes you've taken? And so of the three basic motivations, one of them would be a goal-oriented motivation. For example, this class, number 502, Mayer University, if you want to teach at Mayer University, well, this is a prerequisite that you learn some professional strategies and record keeping and rubrics and syllabus and that sort of thing. So you need to, so here's a goal. I'm going to take 502, not because I have Monday nights free, but because I want to teach at MU, and this is what I need to do. So there's a reason to take it. Okay, another goal. Maybe learning. I simply want to learn. It isn't necessary that I need a certificate, but I want to learn more about teaching. I want the content. So the first group are people that want the certificate. The second group are people that want the content. They want to learn how to do this. And then the third group would be, and people could be, you know, partially of all of these, but the third group is more of a social reason, a social motivation. I want to have this human contact with other heart friends. I want to be with people and listen to their stories, learn something, but mostly just to have this human connection. These are all extremely wonderful, valid reasons to be taking a class. And so when you're teaching, you might, you know, realize that people have different reasons. They're all not coming for a certificate, or all not coming, they want to learn your content, and they're all not coming to socialize, but some of each. And as a teacher, I want to help them meet their goal. If they're coming for the social aspect, I want them to have it. I want them to have the learning. I want them to have the certificate. What it is that they want to get, I want to help them get that. But I also want them to get more than they thought they were going to get. I absolutely love it when a student says to me, I thought I was getting this, and I did get that, but I got so much more. And that is just, that just makes my day, because they got more than they really thought they were going to get. And so that is a balance, to have the goal and the content of the learning. And the, so your classes that you organize may have some of that for everyone. So the person who's just coming to learn may end up making a new friend, or get a certification also, or you can follow that through. Someone who's coming just to be with people might learn something and be thrilled to have that. also, people come to us with different motivations, so other characteristics of the adult learner is what kind of a learner are they, what kind of learners. And you do have a handout that Celeste sent. I don't remember what page it's on. I had it pulled out.
It doesn't have a page number.
Oh, okay.
It has,
well,
13 on mine.
Oh, okay. Well, it has it mentions three different kinds of learners, visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. And I think there's probably dozens and scores of different kinds of learners, but to put them in some kind of a category, those are three of the main ones that are spoken of, to realize that some people learn visually, some people learn more by what they hear, some people by doing something physically. And we don't know what kind of a learner someone is, and it's wonderful if we can have different in our class, we have something for everyone as much as possible. But there's other kinds of learning also, and there's actually seven that I'll mention. So there is the visual, which is spatial, something to see. And we see PowerPoint presentations so much and visuals. And so what we did in this class, Celeste sent out handouts for you. And so those are your visuals. It gives you something to read, something to look at, and something to see with your eyes. Auditory. So people that are auditory also respond to music, but are interested in the words. So we want to use our words well. We want to develop a nice voice tone and to slow down. So when Celeste told me that I need to be at a pretty quick clip, what I'm deciding to do is to leave out some of the material I was going to give you tonight. But what I'm finding myself doing is not only leaving out, but I'm also speeding up. So I don't usually like to talk this fast, so I'm going to try to slow down. But you want to have a nice voice tone and make it pleasing to their ear as much as you can. Kinesthetic is a physical energy, something to do. So right now you may be taking notes, or you may be twisting a paper clip, or doing something else with your hands. Often people doodle. Their hands just want to be busy. I went to a conference one time, an educational conference, where they gave us little toys to play with on the table. And I didn't really, I'm not much of, that wasn't something I really needed that much, but I noticed a lot of people really were definitely playing with objects while they were listening carefully. And then the fourth one is verbal, the linguistic kind of learner. And that means to give them a chance to have something to say or to write. And so in this class, we want you to speak. We want to hear you. And we want and to write your thoughts. So some people learn best by preparing a talk or by writing a paper, and that's where they can think best and organize their thoughts. Instead of just listening or just looking at something else, that they're doing that work themselves. The next one is logical, which is mathematical. And we've tried to provide for that in this class by going class to class. So those who have a logical mind, a mathematical mind, they want to know what the plan is and not just tune in and have no idea where we're going and how we're getting there. So it's a comfort to a lot of people to see the plan ahead of time. So it's recommended that we give them a sense of where we're going, that we know where we're going, and they have confidence in us. And the next one is social, which is interpersonal, to give opportunities for socializing. Well, that may be tea and cookies before the event or tea and cookies after, or it may be introduce the person next to you, or we're going to take minutes to get to know someone that you have never met before. You know, all those things that we do when we go places. It gives an opportunity to make that human contact and not just sit next to a body and have no idea who's in the room with us. And it just warms up the atmosphere. Some people, that's so very, very important to them in their learning process to have to share and to work together. And in this in the corporate world and in the world of business and everywhere these days, people are recognizing the importance of interpersonal skills, being a team player, not just an individual person being able to work together with other people. So that's an important way of learning. And the last one I would mention is the person who learns best in a solitary way, called intrapersonal, I-N-T-R-A, personal, instead of intrapersonal. This person works better alone, and we need to be sure we are respecting people's personal space. Not everyone wants to go to a workshop and be constantly talking to other people or constantly listening to the other students. They came to listen to the person who is teaching the class, and they expect to hear that, and so to respect that. So how can we, in a class, put elements of all of this? And so it's interesting to go through this and to think, oh, what can I do to serve this kind of learner in some way? But the main points I would say about this would be to slow down and give them time to take in information. Often, I think PowerPoint presentations are great because generally, my experience is what they put on the screen is the same thing they're saying verbally. So they're putting their notes up there, basically. But it's not a good idea to put something on a screen to look at and then be saying something different. A person then has to choose, am I going to look or am I going to listen? And personally, for me, I just close down or make a choice. I can't listen and look at the same time generally. Sometimes I can, but if it's new information, I have to make a choice. And the other point that I would make about this is to listen and observe, and that is be a scientist. Listen, observe, see how you can support your students, your audience's development, and you may need to adjust as you go from the signs you're seeing, from what you're hearing, and from what you're observing with them. And as I said before, see what you can do to help them meet their goal, but then give them more than they expect. We need to be what they need us to be. Now, if we happen to be a gregarious, animated, extroverted person with a big aura and very friendly, sometimes we need to pull it in and quiet down a little bit. And sometimes they need that. Sometimes if we're a quiet, reserved person, we need to be extroverted, we need to be gregarious and animated for the sake of our students. So we may have our own, we all have our own personalities in our way, but when we're teachers, we need to be what they need us to be. And we need to forget ourselves and give them what can help them in this wonderful path of transformation. So I'll just close my comments with saying that I see myself not so much as a teacher but as a supporter of this transforming process. And in order to help someone else transform themselves in small or big ways, we don't know what it is that what seed may be planted. In order to support that, we need to constantly be transforming ourselves. We need to give them the best of who we are, and to be in that process ourselves, and to share that with them and tell our stories and to be real with them, be who we really are and be willing to share that. And so I think that's where I will close.
Thank you, Anita. Now, I'm going to take about 5 minutes and just add a couple more things, and then we can talk about what we want to do with our last topic tonight. So one of the things that I've learned, these are a few things I've learned about teaching adults. Generally, they like to have autonomy, which means they like to be in control of what part of the learning they're going to be responsible for, what part of the learning they want to be assessed on, what part of the learning they want to go off in a different direction with. So you try to give adult learners a little more autonomy than you would give, say, 18 or 19-year-old. They also like lateral relationships with the professor, so it's not like you're so much older than them. In some cases,
you're younger than they are as a student, or older and a younger, an older teacher and a younger student. They also appreciate it when you take the role of facilitator as opposed to somebody who's in charge of them in some way. Anita just finished saying you help to facilitate their transformation, so you're the facilitator. They also, adult learners also like to have input and choice, so they like to, in some cases, tell you what they want to learn, and you might want to give them some choices about what it is that they might could choose from, so that you don't necessarily go in there with your agenda all in place, and you know, you might give more of a smorgasbord approach. In some cases it's appropriate, other cases it wouldn't be. Also, adult learners like to share their life experiences, and they have many more years of experience than younger students, and they're very willing usually to bring that life experience into the classroom and have it be there to reinforce a concept that you're trying to teach, or to challenge you perhaps with a concept that you're teaching because of their experience has been different. They love to solve problems, so if you can present problems in your teaching, you can give your adult learner something to chew on a little bit and apply their knowledge, their life experience, to solving a problem. My experience is because they went through school back in the days when there wasn't a lot of what's called constructivist learning, which is a way of learning as a process. Learning is more of a process, and I don't have time to go into all right now, but a lot of modern day teaching techniques are based around activities and lots of discussion and lots of coming up with flow charts and getting together all the knowledge we know and all this kind of thing. That can be frustrating for adult learners because they came through school in the days when they were told things, they were given basically a body of knowledge to memorize, and that's their sort of their understanding of knowledge. And as long as that information is useful to them, they don't mind, you know, learning about it in a constructivist way. But if the information is not vital to them, then they do get frustrated with learning that way. They are paying; they're more aware of what they're paying for something, so they want to get their money's worth. So they're much more critical of teaching than younger students in college who just, you know, their parents are paying their way through and they're not really. They didn't make the money necessarily, so they're not as concerned about what it's like in the classroom. So these are all just some things I've learned. Oh, one more. If there are too many activities, sometimes adult learners think you're wasting their time. They didn't come to pay this much money to do this many activities. They came to actually get a body of knowledge. And just, as Anita said, they you know, they want to learn from you. They don't necessarily want to learn from their peers all the time, although they don't mind every now and then, but the whole course isn't based on lots of discussion and learning from one another in the classroom. So those are just a few things that I've learned and try to think about when I'm working with adult groups. Most of the time I don't get to work with adult groups. I work with 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and that's another whole topic altogether. God love them, but, you know... Education has changed a lot in the 20, 30 years since I was in that age bracket.
I had a class once where I had an 18-year-old was the youngest and an 81-year-old was the oldest, and there was all in between, and they all became such best friends. It was really
great.
It was nice.
So now what we were going to do was talk about a few teaching strategies, but now we're at 8:30, so we have a choice. I guess we could spend 10 minutes maybe and go over some of these, or we could just end the class now and start out next week and start right out at the beginning of class and cover as much as we could. It probably is going to take us about an hour into that last class to cover.
We actually
cover.
Started a little bit late, if people would come on. So I don't know if we want to go a little longer. How do people feel about that?
Let's see if there are any objections.
Yeah, if anybody has a problem with staying online for 10 more minutes, if enough of you have a problem, we will stop now. So if you could just come on and tell us that you do have a problem staying on for 10 more minutes. Peace, it's golden. Okay, so what I'm going to then do is, if you don't mind, I just want to get to one thing tonight that's really important. Now, if you'll turn to page 10. What? Okay, if you turn to page 10, you'll see there's 10 and 11 and maybe up to 12 are all pages discussing teaching strategies. And I'm not going to cover what you can read for yourself. But I would like to talk about, somehow there's an echo here.
Might need to have somebody mute.
I wonder if it's Sol's phone. Okay, there, that's gone now. Okay, so we want to think about how we're going to get, no, it's still there. Everybody's muted, right? Sol?
Yes.
Have you done anything differently with the recording? Because I'm hearing an echo of my voice.
No, I haven't. So I don't know where it comes from. I've never heard it before.
Yeah. Okay, well, there, it's gone. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to talk about how you might get going in a workshop or in a class. Remember, Maitreya said, as Anita said, the first thing is to know your audience. So you're going to have to figure out some way to get to know your audience in a limited amount of time because you probably won't have a lot of time. And these are some ways that you can get things going. You don't have to use any one of these. You can use something completely different, but I just had a few examples here. I want to go through them with you. Some people recommend that you start with the key activity that you think of that the group could do to get to know the topic or to get you an idea of what they know about the topic. You could throw out a why question and have small groups work on answering the why question if you have a good why question. I wouldn't recommend that you throw out a why question as an introduction to what you're going to say unless you actually give people time to process that why question. So just to stand up there and say, have you ever wondered why the world is round? And then everyone's minds are going off into their brain, pulling out of their brain all the parts of the brain that have anything to do with why the world is round. And then you come up with something completely different from what there is now sitting in their brain, ready to be processed as information. And then they have to stuff that all back into those little compartments wherever it's stored in the brain, and then clear the brain again to learn what it is that you wanted to talk about with that question. I don't know if I said that too well, but a lot of people, especially with young children, start out with questions, and this is not a good strategy because you'll get every answer, as you know with young children, every answer under the sun, and it has nothing to do with the topic that you're trying to talk about. So if you're going to ask a why question as a key activity, then give people time to actually process it with one another and actually say what was in their head to somebody else. Because once it's said, then it's out of the brain, and then you can go on, and the brain's cleared again. That's one kind of activity that people often use. Another one is to begin with an important skill that they might want to learn and try to introduce your topic by saying, now, if you have this skill, this is what you'll be able to do with this skill. And then that would interest people in learning about it because they can know how they're going to use it. For example, this class, hopefully you'll know what it is that you can do with this information so you're more motivated to learn it than you would be if there was no reason to learn it. Another way is to begin with some kind of an assessment. Previous page, at number 7 on page 10, it says, keep in mind levels of development in the zone of proximal development. Now, the zone of proximal development is something Mother's asked me to talk about several times. Apparently, this is a concept that she thinks is important, and I do too, but it just means that you're trying to determine where you need to go with your information so that you're challenging your learner and not just reviewing what they already know. You need to be in the zone of proximal development, which means you need to be in the zone which is the next approximate idea that they need to be mastering. If you give a material that's too complicated, you lose people and they're frustrated. And if you give material that's too easy, they already know it and they're bored. So you need to figure out what is that range that you in which you talk and that you will actually be informing people in a way that's interesting to them. So a way to do that is to do what we did in this class and give a concept map. Now, I wasn't with you in a classroom to collect those concept maps, but had I been able to do that, I could very quickly have looked at your concept maps, and I would have known what forth. I could have very quickly discerned that without spending a lot of time, without having big discussions, and without interviewing every one of you individually. Although interviewing is another way. You can have your partners interview each other, and then they could write down answers, and then they could turn that paper in to you later at the end of the class, the first class. So hopefully by the time you spend some time with your students, you have some idea of what they know about your topic. Because if you don't do that up front in either informal or formal way, then you may spend 3 weeks talking about something that you didn't need to talk about at all. And the thing that they really wanted to learn, you never get to because you didn't know where they were developmentally. Does that all make sense?
I have a question, Celeste.
Sure.
What if your situation gives you people who have quite different zones? I mean...
Okay, so that's a challenge, and uh-huh. the buzzword for that is it's called differentiated learning. I just love it because it's taken the educational community all these 20 years to come around to what Montessori obviously knew back in 1900. You have to differentiate learning ideally, right? I mean, so you can figure out a way that you can determine if there's different levels, and then you could put people together who are at different levels to discuss it. So maybe you could do this your very first time together, but by the second time, you could analyze what you've got, and you could say, okay, we're going to have partners tonight, and these people are going to work together, and these people are going to work together, and you could determine ahead of time who's going to work with whom based on what you think they know. And then you give them slightly different tasks than the beginners, let's just say. So... But you couldn't do that unless you had something that you had done with them the first time you were with them to determine what it was that they knew. So some way to determine knowledge is very, very important. And these are all just different ways. Okay, then another way is a template. Template's something like a worksheet or something that someone else has already done, and you've gone to that class, and you were there, and it worked really well in that workshop, so you thought, oh, well, I'll just try it in mine. So then you just apply something that, you know, somebody else created that you really haven't given a lot of thought to. Worked once for them, maybe it'll work for me, and maybe it will. So, you know, different kinds of questionnaires are sometimes used, you know, fill in, you know, what you know about something or an experience you had with something or whatever. Okay, so another technique that you can use is what's called the jigsaw pattern. And it can be used a lot of different ways. I really like it a lot, and I've used it very successfully, and so I'm going to teach that to you. That's number 8 on page 12. You could start out with a question. You could start out with information. You could start out by having people brainstorm, heartstream. There are many ways you could organize this, but basically what you do is you divide the group into smaller groups, depending on the size of the group. You want to get about 4 people or 5 people maximum in a group. If you get too many more than that, then not everybody is contributing. So say if you have 20 people, then you're going to divide it up into 4 groups. If you have 30 people, you know, you see what I mean. So maybe 80 people, you're going to divide it up into 20 groups of 4 each. And you're going to give each group a different topic to talk about. So if you had your 80 people, you'd have to have 20 different topics or variations on the topic. But you give each of the smaller groups a topic to talk about. And no one else has a topic except the 4 people or the 5 people in that group. Or it's a question to answer. Or it's a problem to solve. Or it's something to heartstream on or whatever. And they answer their question or that topic. They come up with their own body of information, which you can have them record on either large sheets of paper or small 8.5 sheets of paper. But somebody needs to record the information, and they all need to know what that body of knowledge is. And after a certain period of time, whatever it's going to be, 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, then you switch around so that you have a new group, new groups formed with one person from each group. So there's one person from the first group, one person from the second group, one person from the third group, and one person from the fourth group, representing all the bodies of knowledge that each of those groups have come up with separately. But now they're together in a group. So the number one person teaches everybody else in the group what they learned over in their small group. The number two person teaches everybody in their new group what they learned in their number two group. The number three person teaches everybody what they learned in their number three group, and so forth. And so then you have the body of information in the room, the collective knowledge and wisdom of everybody in the room is communicated to everybody else in the room very effectively and efficiently. Any questions about the jigsaw? Well, try it sometime if you've never used it, because it's really a wonderful thing. And everybody, you see, then has, yes?
I said I used it in a class. I took a CLAD class, like an ESL class, and we did it for reading because we had these textbooks that were really long and involved, and so we would break, the teacher would break it up into, okay, you read, you know, paragraphs this and this and this, you guys read page this, you guys read this, and then once you've read it, then you'll make a mind map or a concept map of what was in that section, and then we all stood up in the middle, in the front of the classroom, and one or two people from the group then presented to everybody about what it was about.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing I like about it is because when you go into that new group, and then you're the only person in the new group that knows all the information. So it gives you status in the sense that you're responsible for that information, and it gives you some self-esteem because you're representing that body of knowledge to your peers, and everybody gets to speak, so there's not one or two people that do all the talking. And so each person reports out, and so at the end of it, you have more of a sense of community, and I think it's very effective.
Celeste, so. it could be a nice thing to do with, like, a small pocketbook if you were having a study group or something, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've done that. This group does Chapter 1, and this next group does Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 and Chapter 4, and then they get together, and one person describes what they talked about with Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 and so forth. Yeah, it's very good. It's called the Jigsaw. Mm-hmm. So those are just some concepts that I wanted to share. Now we're past our time, and I want to stop that at this point, and we'll continue. We'll pick up next week with some more teaching strategies. I wanted to just re-go over the homework just really quickly here. You're not ready to send in your syllabus yet or your rubrics unless you're completely done. Now, you may be, but you haven't heard all the teaching strategies yet, so you might like to wait until the end of next week before you send us your syllabus and your rubrics so that everything is finally finished and complete. So right now for this week, your homework is to finish your rubric and finish your syllabus and then, you know, be applying teaching strategies that are in your handouts and just the few that I was able to discuss. Think about what you're actually going to do now. You've got your topics, you know, but what are you actually going to do with your topics with real people in a room? You know, what's going to actually happen? Kind of create a little movie in your mind. I'm going to do this. They're going to do that. Then I'm going to do this. And then they're going to do that. And try to think it through as best you can. And get as much of that detail into your syllabus as you can. Any questions about that?
Can those of us who are working and also going on the Pacific Fire Ring trip turn ours in sometime in January?
Yeah. I want to say that until, you know, when your assignments are turned in, and it can be any time, it doesn't have to be this next week, when all the course materials have been sent to us, then we will issue your certificate. And we recognize there are various strengths here with, you know, people so forth. So, but please don't send them before next Monday, and then we're leaving on Wednesday, so Anita and I will not look at a thing until January, so you really have the rest of the month to take your time and send the materials to us. So I guess unless there's some burning questions.
You want teaching strategies in the syllabus? I thought the syllabus was like the outline.
It is the outline, but now you've done the outline. So
right.
Now you've got to be thinking in your mind, okay, I've got my topics now.
Yeah.
Now what? Am I just going to stand up there and talk for the whole hour?
Right.
While I do other things besides talk? If you're just going to lecture, then obviously there's no teaching strategies.
So you want the teaching strategies on a separate paper?
No, I just kind of put them in there. So like, let's just say, next week we're going to do teaching strategies. Let's just say we were all together in one room. Well, we could use a jigsaw to do teaching strategies maybe, and then we would practice our jigsaw, and that would be how we would teach the teaching strategies. Part two, let's just say. You know, some things are done with some things are taught with lecture, some things are taught with discussion, some things are taught with various different teaching strategies. I've given you many handouts. I also gave you those extra five sheets with all different kinds of ways you can present material. Did you see that? The lectures and the debates and the whatever. There's a lot of them, role playing and all of that. You look through all of that material and you decide what of that is valuable to use in the delivery of your information. And you stick that in your syllabus under your topic.
So Les, this sounds almost like what we would call a lesson plan. But
yeah.
Because when I think of syllabus, I think of just the bare bones topics. But you're talking about topics
but
and
I'm asking them. I'm asking you to expand that out now with your teaching strategy. So what are you actually going to do?
Yeah, okay.
See, so up to this week, you decided what you were going to say. You're going to what topics or what information you're going to convey. But now, what are you going to have your students doing and what's actually going to be happening in that room with you?
Yeah.
Five sentences or maybe, and they can go for a whole 2 hours with five sentences. But beginning teachers, people who are not used to this, they need to write down, they need to think of it as a movie and project it, what's going to happen now, this is going to happen, then that's going to happen, and they're going to do that, and I'm going to do that. And, of course, it never will be like that in real life, but there's a value to thinking it through in your head. Okay, so and I'm going to spend 10 minutes, and we're going to discuss this thing for 10 minutes, and then I'm going to have them talk to their neighbor, and then whatever. You see what I'm saying? You just think it out. Think it out now what you might actually do in a real-life situation to get this information conveyed and help people to learn it. So, it's not as hard as you think, but it will take a little thinking about what I want to, some choices, you know. What will I have them do? So, any questions? Otherwise, Anita, would you be willing to seal us, please?
Okay. Thank you all for staying with us. We appreciate it so much and look forward to seeing you next week. Beloved world teachers, beloved Jesus and Kathumi, beloved Gautama and Maitreya, God and Goddess Meru, El Moria, Great Divine Director, and all of our sponsoring Masters of the Heart Center and of Meru University, we are so grateful for this opportunity to be together tonight as we move forward in our own individual divine plans, as we move forward by God's grace to transform ourselves daily and to help others support our brothers and sisters on the path, our brothers and sisters that have never heard of the path, the elementals, all of sentient life, to support their development and to bring more light, more light, more light on this planet, for the light of God never fails. Let's say that together three times. The light of God never fails. The light of God never fails. The light of God never fails. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, everyone. You're going to do a great job. Just be confident.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.